It's Wednesday, February 10th. Actor and United Nations Goodwill Ambassador Angelina Jolie has arrived in Haiti. Currently, for one Haitian orphan, life is really going to be the pits. This is The Current.
Good morning and welcome to The Current. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. You want to bet a lot of people wondered what was going through Beethoven's head when he composed that masterpiece. Enough people, in fact, that his skull was once a coveted commodity. In fact, cranioclepsy was rampant around the time of his death, and no gifted musician or intellectual was safe in their grave. Behind all the skull snatching was a now discredited medical theory. And in the case of Beethoven's skull, all roads lead to California. That story is in our third half hour. Also today, in a country of doctor shortages and crowded hospitals, the role of the physician assistant is gaining prominence in healthcare plans. Proponents say they can improve efficiency. Critics question their training and their effectiveness. We've got that story in our second half hour. And it was one four-digit number, 2035, but it represented a potential environmental catastrophe. News that the Himalayan glaciers could be gone within less than 3 decades. That seemingly true statement got a lot of attention in 2007 when the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released a series of reports that won the scientists of the IPCC a Nobel Prize. Except that fact was wrong, and now there's a cold wind blowing through the fabric of legitimacy that has blanketed the climate change argument. That is where The Current begins today.
My reaction is I'm not going to stand down, I'm going to stand up.
That is Rajendra Pachauri, the chair of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He was speaking to the BBC late last month amidst a growing number of calls for his resignation. But Mr. Pachauri was unapologetic.
I was elected, re-elected by acclamation, essentially, I imagine, because everybody was satisfied with my performance on the fourth assessment report. So I want to tell the skeptics, I want to tell the vested interests who see me as the face and the voice of the science of climate change that I'm in no mood to oblige them. I'm going to remain chairman of the IPCC for my entire term.
Well, since then, the backlash against the IPCC has grown. The latest criticism stems from a statement in its fourth assessment report in 2007, specifically that the Himalayan glaciers could melt away by 2035, threatening the water supply of hundreds of millions of people. The problem is that it was wrong. And now Glaciergate, as it has come to be known, has taken on a life of its own and threatens to undermine the credibility of what had been one of the most respected scientific organizations in the world. Andrew Weaver has worked extensively with the IPCC. He's a climatologist at the University of Victoria. He helped write portions of the last three IPCC reports, though not the section in question, and he's in Victoria. Good morning.
Good morning.
How damaging has the fallout been from this glacial data to the IPCC's credibility?
Well, there's no question that it has had an impact on public perception of the IPCC, but in reality, it is rather insignificant in terms of the big picture. We have 3,000 pages of scientific assessment, and we're focusing on one particular statement, which is incorrect, should not have been there. It points to some issues that need to be dealt with respect to communication between the various working groups in IPCC. But it doesn't change the science. So while it's been spun out of control through various special interest groups as somehow damaging the credibility, and without doubt that resonates with various aspects of the public, it hasn't changed anything.
You make the point that it's insignificant, but it really was a prediction that the water supply for hundreds of millions of people would be drying up within 25 years. That's why wouldn't people pay attention to that?
You're absolutely right. This first, we have to point out the differences between the various working groups. There's three working groups in IPCC. Working Group 1 is the physical science. Working Group 2 is the impacts, adaptation, and vulnerability. So that's the social aspects or the human dimensions of the science. Number 3, Working Group 3 looks at mitigation, which is policy, economics, and engineering in some sense. So much of these kind of this gate fest is coming out of the Working Group 2. We have to recognize that Working Group 2 is largely written by people in the field of social sciences. Now, so we're asking people in social sciences to have a standard of a scientific, a physical science-based standard in terms of what is deemed to be acceptable references or not. And, you know, that's not as common within the social science community. It is more acceptable to refer to some aspects of what is called gray literature, i.e. not peer-reviewed literature.
Well, fair enough, but and I don't want to belabor this specific point too long, but the people who are critical of the IPCC are always told, well, these are peer-reviewed things. So if you're actually writing on stuff that's not peer-reviewed, if you're allowing for gray literature, isn't that the problem? Why is that okay?
In my mind, it's not okay. I would agree that this is why, you know, my colleagues actually have been involved in the science aspect, and we're less involved in the physical, in the social science human dimensions component. So this is a standard we hold in Working Group 1, the science standard, and I think we're trying to tarnish the science by some sort of loose application of some aspects of the review process or what is deemed to be acceptable in the Working Group 2. So it is a problem. I mean, we can't deny that it's a problem, but this is a 3,000-page document. We're picking on one or two statements. You know, we hear about Amazon Gate, which is actually should be called Footnote Gate, you know, where this whole ridiculous hoopla about the Amazon statements were actually just because of an incorrect footnote. The footnote was numbered wrong.
Okay, but that's the fact that there was a report that global warming could wipe out 40% of the rainforest. It was based on an unsubstantiated claim in a report from the World Wildlife Fund that took its report from something else on the logging and burning going on in the Amazon, not rainfall, and extrapolated it, right?
Well, that's not quite correct. There are actually science studies that have looked at that. If you, for example, there's a study by Peter Cox and our colleagues in the UK that suggested a collapse of the Amazon forest as a consequence of greenhouse gas emissions. So there are science studies out there.
But he wasn't footnoted, was he?
No,
it was the World Wildlife Fund that was footnoted.
There's a problem with the footnote. The footnote should have gone to the original science literature and not the World Wildlife Fund Foundation report. Absolutely.
Okay, but you're saying these are small things, but there is an issue of perception, and no one has been held accountable for these mistakes. The chair of the IPCC, Rajendra Pachauri, has refused to step down or even apologize. Is that right?
Well, he has refused to step down, but I don't think he should step down. I mean, let's be realistic.
Well, should he apologize?
Well, on behalf of the IPCC has issued a correction to that particular statement on the website. That is what you do. There will be other errors in the report, I'm sure. I mean, these are humans. This is a big institution, the IPCC, writing a report that in which humans are involved. There will be other errors. And surely you can imagine with the kind of libertarian movement out there to try to do anything it can to discredit the people involved in the science, they'll find others and they'll make a big deal out of it and echo blog it all around the world. The fact is that Pachauri is not responsible for writing that. He is the spokesperson for the IPCC. He's the head of the organization. I think what we should see is a recognition, as we have seen, that there have been some errors. I think it was inappropriate for him, apparently, to describe people who criticize this as talking about voodoo science. That's not what you would expect from the president of such an organization. But the reality is, there's nothing for him to resign. I think that UNFCCC will take a look at what's happened when they next meet.
UNFCCC stands for?
United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, the organization that actually...
Okay, I get lost with all the acronyms.
Acronym soup. Well, the organization that started the IPCC, they'll have a look at where things are going and make recommendations because ultimately they appoint the president.
Well, you know, you make the point that there's a libertarian movement looking for mistakes. If that's the case, didn't you hand them? I mean, like you're saying you have critics out there, but how can you blame the critics?
Well, you can't.
You gave it to them.
In fact, the person who found it was actually a scientist. So there were scientists who found this error, not the libertarian movement. So, you know, where I blame here is I think that there's some desperate desire to undercut anything that's built up. You know, you build something up, then you try to undercut it. And we get great satisfaction in society of knocking down these institutions that have got some good reputation. It's kind of a sad statement of our society, actually. But so, you know, the IPCC has over the last, since 1990, has issued 4 reports. They've got bigger and bigger, it's all written by scientists and social scientists who are volunteering their time. No one's getting reimbursed for this. Enormous amount of work done off the side of the desk. It's an incredibly intense peer review process. But the process is not perfect. Mistakes will happen, as we saw.
Well, will the process change so that mistakes are found?
I am hoping there will always be mistakes. I mean, it's human nature. Perfect.
But again, we're talking about a mistake that said in 25 years, the water source for hundreds of millions of people will disappear if we do not act.
Yeah. No,
that's different than, I've got a little note here that should have, you know. I mean, there are implications to these mistakes.
People
run with them. And the IPCC,
right.
You know, on the strength of that 2007 report and the scientists related to it, won the Nobel Prize.
Right. That's absolutely correct. Now, there's no doubt that things have to change. And I would argue, I mean, I think many of us would think that this is an important example of why we need to have the social science community in the working group 2 engaging the scientific community in working group 1 when assessments are being done, because you cannot, I mean, you need to ground any of these assessments in the science. You can't just have statements like that making it through. And you know, it's embarrassing and it's unacceptable. There's no question. But that doesn't mean that the science itself is somehow undercut. It means that there was a bad mistake, and whoever put that in there and whoever was the review editor for that chapter should be accountable.
You are talking about a big machine, and for the critics of the IPCC, that is part of the problem. Mm-hmm. I have a clip from Lawrence Solomon. He's a columnist. He's the author of the book The Deniers. This is what he has to say.
The IPCC should be disbanded. It really has no purpose at all. I think the Indian government is doing the right thing. The Indian government has decided that it cannot base its future on so shoddy an organization as the IPCC, and it's created its own scientific body that it can control, that would be accountable to the government. That's something that other countries should do. We all have our own scientific establishments. There's no reason that all of the scientific establishments of countries around the world need to be coordinated by the IPCC. We can all produce our own research. We can all meet at international gatherings. We can all test our theories against each other. The ones that hold water will be adopted by others, and those that are suspect will be rejected. That's a much sounder basis for promoting science.
What do you think of what Lawrence Solomon is saying there, Andrew Weaver?
Well, in fact, if he'd investigated what was going on before he actually spoke, he would realize that most governments already have such organizations in place. For example, I was involved in a U.S. national assessment, a very extensive assessment that lasted over the last number of years in parallel to the IPCC. We have the Royal Society in Britain that assesses various aspects of the climate problem. We have similar things in Australia and in Canada. So what's happening in India is no different from what was happening in other countries, that there are government. I mean, you want to have an understanding from your own national perspective of what climate change means to you. And so governments around the world have established such independent organizations to actually look at that, or they contract through things like the national academies of various governments. So India is doing nothing different from what other governments have done. The reason why a lot of people don't like the IPCC is because it's a UN organization. Now, you find here that there's a subtext to a lot of what's being being criticized to the IPCC, that people do not want the UN dictating stuff. There's a worry somehow that this is the UN is really tasked with building some global governance, and is going to, you know, run the world. I mean, there's almost some. I'm not including Solomon in this, of course, but there's some kind of global paranoia that we're going to be run by this Uber government out of Geneva. So people don't like, there are elements of this libertarian movement that don't like the UN, don't want the UN involvement, and the IPCC represents that in the science framework. But of course, the UN is very, very important for this problem, because if we rely exclusively on countries like USA, China, India, developing policies that are benefit themselves, who's going to speak for those countries who don't have those resources? Who's going to speak for Africa?
I'd like to ask you more about Mr. Pachauri for a moment. How do you think he has handled this scandal?
Well, not well at all. I mean, let's recognize, we have to recognize, first of all, that the leadership of the IPCC, the scientists or social scientists who are writing the chapters as lead authors, are doing this on a volunteer basis. He's not paid to do this. He's doing this off the side of his desk. Scientists do not have training in public relations or media engagement. And this is quite clear from what the way we've seen very, you know, very effective public relations campaigns trying to discredit anybody or anything associated with the IPCC. You know, when you have a bunch of scientists, they look like deer with their caught in headlights when this happens. We look at the emails that happened in East Anglia. I mean, we have, rather than trying to get ahead of this story, they just kind of go into hiding for a week and go, oh my goodness, what's going on here? I don't know how to deal with this. And the story goes viral. I mean, this is the same thing happening with this Glacier Gate. We have, rather than saying, recognizing straight up front and saying there's an error, this shouldn't have been here, we start, you know, trying to defend that error. Well, the error is unacceptable. And but people don't know how to, you know, we're not professionals in this business. We're just doing this off the side of our desk. And so you can, you know, it's like Pee-wee Pups going to play the NHL when it comes to media relations. You know, we're the Pee-wee Pup team, the kids who are barely skating on this, and you go and play in NHL superstar team.
But again, you Pee-wee Pups know that you're talking about things that people will decide major policy on.
Right.
And rather quickly. I mean, there have been world meetings of leaders where people have talked about real economic changes, massive changes based on what the pups are saying.
Well, we're the hockey team when it comes to that's a horrible analogy because I could just see the skeptics going around and saying, "Oh, we're relating it to time series of tree rings." And stuff. But what IPCC does is it informs policy. Okay, that's its task. It's not tasked with making policy. So you're absolutely right. It's important that when you are informing policy, you do so in an accurate and transparent manner. And that, I would argue, has absolutely been done in Working Group 1 through at least 15 years I've been involved with it. Working Group 2, I thought it was. I'm sure it is. I think there's a few unfortunate mistakes, and they're unacceptable. But
you make the point that your job is to give information that would inform policy. Has the IPCC crossed the line into advocacy?
The IPCC as an organization has not, and it will not, because it cannot. Individuals within the IPCC are entitled to their own personal view on policy recommendations. I mean, I have my views, as do economists who have their views, and Pachauri has his views. Now, the key aspect with the chair of the IPCC is he has to be, because he's representing, he's the voice of the IPCC, he needs to be clear. If he's talking about policy, he needs to be clear it's his opinion as opposed to the IPCC opinion. So there have been some examples where people have thought that perhaps he was saying the IPCC tells people to stop eating meat, for example, or the IPCC believes the U.S. should do this. Well, in fact, the IPCC has no business, nor can it, prescribe policy. The IPCC informs those policy discussions.
Mm. On a personal note, is there a chance that scientists like yourself simply won't volunteer their time when it comes to the IPCC, given the fallout?
I think that's a very good question. I mean, I've asked myself the same question. I did volunteer that I would be available for the next IPCC assessment if so chosen. I don't know that I would be selected. I might be. I'm not sure. I mean, I've done it before. Maybe it's time for someone else to get involved. I think most people would still want to be involved because it's a very rewarding experience to actually, you know, work with other scientists to assess the state of our understanding. You learn so much about areas that are not your own particular, you know, niche in the science wall, so to speak. Is that you, for example, if you're working on a projections chapter, you'll have people there involved in glacier projection. They're not in Working Group 2. They should be in Working Group 1. You have people involved in land surface change. You have people involved in numerical model development. Also, a diversity of people. It's a fascinating process to go through. So I think scientists are ultimately driven by curiosity. This is a wonderful process to kind of feed that curiosity, and I suspect it will continue on. You know, you can rest assured that the Working Group 1 will be all over Working Group 2 this time.
I was just going to say, are you going to have a meeting with them? Yeah, okay.
Absolutely, because it is embarrassing. I mean, look, when you're a scientist who's been working in this area for many, many years, and you have some flippant statement written in Working Group 2 report that you're looking at it aghast, because you never read that particular section, because it's buried in the midst of some 1,000-page document, and you're too busy writing your own document. And you look at this aghast 3 years later when someone's pointing out, and you ask yourself, I'm asking myself the same question. How on earth did that get in there? As most of my colleagues are. It shouldn't have been there. So there's a problem, and that problem has to be addressed.
Andrew Weaver, we have to leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Andrew Weaver is a climatologist at the University of Victoria. He helped write the last three reports for the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, though not the sections that have been questioned. If you have thoughts on what you're hearing today, call us, write to us, go to our website, cbc.ca/thecurrent, and click on the Contact Us link. Call us toll free at 1-877-287-7366. Tweet us on Twitter at TheCurrentCBC, or write to us at Box 500, Station A, Toronto, M5W1E6. Well, physician assistants are working their way into hospitals in a few provinces, and supporters say they can help narrow the gaps in our healthcare system. But critics are questioning the adequacy of their training. We'll have that story in our next half hour. And in our last half hour, you know you're breaking new ground when you have to invent a word for the phenomenon you are describing. And in Colin Dickey's case, that word was cranioclepty.
It's basically the story of how the skulls of some famous people throughout the 19th century were stolen by phrenologists who were looking at these skulls to better understand where creative genius came from.
Obsession with skulls, from Beethoven to Hitler. That is in our last half hour. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. This is The Current on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius Satellite Radio 137.